thank you for this arrangement. I'm very honored to be with you. It's important to talk with the community here. It's important to talk to the people. We are, as a Palestinian people there in Gaza and in the West Bank, all the time we are looking to the world, what they are doing for us, what they're hearing from us. The important issue is everybody there outside the country know about Gaza and West Bank from the news. The news is covering the crisis, the news is covering the numbers of the people whom had been killed, the news is covering some small issues about the life. But the reality in Gaza and West Bank, this is a real life. It's a lot of people there. They are living in very difficult conditions of life. They are having dreams. They are having them own life. They are thinking about the future. They are having children. They are trying to learn how to be part of the world, part of the peace in the world. But in the same time, it's difficult to talk about peace. It's difficult to talk about any kind of new arrangement in the life while you are under the occupation. The occupation is the biggest problem. The occupation is our problem. Sometimes we have a lot of things to talk about when we talking about life, about the daily life of the Palestinian there, especially in Gaza. In 1993, it was the peace agreement, if we can call it a peace agreement between Israel and PLO, it's Oslo Agreement. At that time, it was too difficult to the Palestinian to believe that maybe a peace will happen. And everybody think maybe it is not a peace agreement, but it is a gate. It is we can enter to the new period of time, which maybe change our life for better. The problem of the peace is that if it is not to change the daily life of the people, so why the people will support peace? Why the people will be talking about peace and about the future? Well, this peace changed the life to worse than before. This is the idea of the change which happened in Palestine. Excuse me, because it's some technical problems. I want just to show you the maps of Gaza and West Bank. We are talking how much difficult to live in area. A small area, 350 kilometers square, live in Gaza more than 1.8 million Palestinians in Gaza Strip. Most of them are refugees. Gaza, it is very, very small area. It's not more than a town. In 1948, when the Palestinian Nakba happened, 500,000 Palestinians came from historic Palestine, from Jaffa, Lod, Ramla, all the places to Gaza. And now we hear about the refugees problem in Europe because 500,000 or something like that came from Syria to Europe. All of Europe, they are in very big problem because of those 500,000. Those, the same number of the people, they came to Gaza in 48. So you can find in Gaza a lot of people, but most of them are refugees. They left all of them land there, they left them houses, they left everything in historic Palestine, and they came to Gaza being refugees. So this is that day, everything changed in Gaza. In a place to be Gaza, a place of orange, a place of farms, a place of a good weather and clean air, to a refugees camp. And this refugees camp continued for 4 years and years. In 67, the Israeli occupied Gaza. So they took all those people with the refugees, with the land, and them trying to make it less than before, they start building settlements. And they built nine settlements in Gaza, in the places which the best water there, the best area for farming, the best place near the beach. So they changed all of Gaza, and the people start being as part of people. They are in prison. In 1993, 1994, when the peace talks started and with the Oslo Agreement happened, the people start thinking, oh, we will start a new life. We can build our new life. We can educate our children, and then we can go to build our state in the Gaza and West Bank. But suddenly everything changed after the assassination of Rabin. Taban, the assassination of Rabin happened from Israeli guy, not from Palestinian. So when they killed Rabin, they changed everything, and the rules start to move to the war, not to the peace. Because after the killing of Rabin, the Israeli people elected Benjamin Netanyahu the first time. And in the first speech of Benjamin Netanyahu, he said that I'll not continue this peace process with the Palestinians. I'll not give them more land. I'll not give them part of Jerusalem. I'll not give them the right of return. I'll not give them 67 borders. So it means that's no way to talk. And it's no result for any negotiation. But even that, the negotiation continues. But till now, 20 years after, there are no any kind of results. In Gaza, it is not only this difficult life which we talk about, but we are talking about something else, wars in Gaza, 3 wars in 6 years. You can imagine, just now, if we can see this photo, it is the Rafah border, the only gate from Gaza to the world. It's closed all the time from the Egyptian side because there are problems between Hamas in Gaza and the Egyptian government. So this is the way which the Palestinians trying to travel. We have many different pictures, just to show you how it's difficult to travel if it is open. These photos, while the border, the crossing is open. But it's enough to tell you that in 2015, all the year, this crossing opened for 13 days only. 13 days only. In each day, the Egyptian allows something like between 300 to 400 Palestinians to leave Gaza. So we can talk about 4,000. From the 2 million, they left Gaza in 2015. And in the same time, you can imagine how much people from Gaza they need to travel. They need to go to schools outside the country. They have scholarship. They have people going to the hospitals because the medicine then it is not enough in Gaza and it is not good. The quality it is not good for medical in Gaza. So they'll want to leave to other countries for treatment, but nobody can leave. And myself, it's happened with me last year. I had a fellowship in Harvard University here in the United States. It was the Nieman Fellowship. It is one of the best fellowship in the world. But I couldn't leave Gaza at that time, so I lost it. Today, this time, when I came to University of Chicago, this time, with all the connection with the University of Chicago, the Institute of Politics, the NBC News, it talks to me 35 days to arrive from Gaza to Chicago. You can imagine that. This is me. I'm a journalist working with NBC News. I'm going to University of Chicago. But it talks to me 35 days to arrive here. You can imagine what will happen with the others. And I'm going back to Gaza now this week on Thursday. And I'm not sure that I can go to Gaza. I'm going to Egypt and waiting there, I don't know, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. It could be forever. Because nobody trusts when this border will be open, when this crossing will be open. This is kind of the symbols which show you how is the difficult, the life is difficult there. You have no idea if you want, even if you have money, if you have family outside, if you have everything, but you want to go to study. For example, my boys, they will finish, next year they will finish them high school. I'm dreaming to send them to study here in the United States because I want them to study in good universities. But I'm not sure that I can send them. So for you, it's easy to just to have your passport and to take your passport and your bag and go to the airport, going everywhere in the world. This is the Gazian and the Palestinian. The Palestinian saw it in the TV, and they are dreaming about that. When they saw this dream, how to travel, not in this way, just to go to the airport and having the flight. This is one of the issues. But the reality, the real life, the daily life there is more important and it's more difficult than that. If we talk about, you know, small things, the electricity. We have only 3 hours electricity a day. And sometimes no. So if we are in very good situation, we have 5 or 4 or 6 hours. But this is the way which we live in Gaza. It is not issue of money, of house. You can fight for money. In my house, last month, my wife, she waited for 2 months to find a cooking gas for the kitchen. So we start cooking on fire, like this way. You can imagine now, in 2016, we have no cooking gas. And we cannot, this is the way which our children is studying. And then they are, even, you know, I'm teaching the university there, and sometimes I'm trying to ask my students just to do more, study more. It's important for you to study. They ask me, you know, they came before the examination, they are not ready. Why? There are no electricity. I cannot say anything because I know that. The electricity that is controlling our life. If I want to go to visit some friend, I cannot go if he has no electricity because I need the elevator just to arrive to his apartment. And in the same time, if I have electricity in my home, I'll not leave, I'll not go, I'm just staying, watch TV, yes. You know, the first day I came to Chicago, it was in November, and it was very cold. And, you know, just to feel that you have air condition, it is something strange for me. It is air condition. And many things like this, it is a small thing, it is very, very small thing, but it's changed the life. If your children all the time in this dark, of course the mind will be dark. It is not easy to talk to them, to explain to them that we are part of the world. We are living in friendship with the others. This is, you know, this is one of the houses. It's burned because the candles and the fire inside the apartment. They want heat. And more than 16 children in 2014, 2015 died because they are using candles and they're sleeping, or they are using fire and they are sleeping and forget about it. So it is difficult to explain to the people how much you know, this is as a cartoon, it said that this is the time for the electricity cutting in our area. So this is everything in this issue is very difficult. Even if you want to use your car, I have my car, but sometimes I cannot use it because I have no enough benzene, no gasoline for it, no fuel for it. We need sometimes to have fuel for the car or for the electricity generator, for example, to stay in the gas station for 1 day. Just waiting, and maybe it is we haven't, because the Israelis give, you know, this is only one gate from Israel, which they supply the supply for Gaza. So sometimes for security reason, maybe one soldier, he decided to close it. Oh, he said, I feel something happened there, so close it, and they close it. And then we stay with no food, with no gas, cooking gas, with no fuel, with nothing. And this is the second thing which we talk. But when we talk about the health, the first thing about the health is the water. Gaza in very bad, this is, you know, this is the gas line. It could be like this 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month. So each time you put your thing here, and you send your daughter or your wife or your son just to stay around, because maybe they are not saying to us, okay, this month we will not give you. Just be quiet in your home, and the next month come to take. No, just every day we having the same hope that, oh, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, and we are waiting, look to those people. And then they ask those people to be optimistic and to support the peace, and to talk about friendship, and to talk about how to build the trust between the two sides. And the worse than that, when they're talking about how to build a new leadership. You can imagine from those children, from those young people, they are thinking all the time about them. A small thing in the daily life, it is difficult to talk to them about anything else. The United Nations said, and the International Bank said, in 2020, Gaza will not be a place for life. I think they are wrong. Now it is not. Maybe 2 years ago it is not. We are talking about this situation. Look to those children, how they are carrying them drink water. When I saw the water here in the lake, the fresh water in the lake, and I'm dreaming, oh, sometimes I remember one day I returned back home around to 9 or 10 o'clock in the evening, and it was no water. And my children, they are sleeping. So I went to, I tried to find water. It took me something like 3 hours to find the place just to have water. Even if I want to buy water, most of the shops are closed at night. So this is the way which we are living in Gaza. And in the same time, all the time we are thinking about how to change this life, how to be part of this international life, how to be part of the world, and we want to be part of the world. This is small things. Look to this, the eyes of this girl. She went to the drink water, but there are no water there. This is the reality life in Gaza. This is without the wars. In the last 6 years, 3 wars, the first one in 2008-2009, and the second one in 2012, but the worst one in 2014. During this, I'll not talk about 2008 war and 2012 war, and this is, you know, maybe this is strange. When we start talking about the last war, and we forget about that war, this is one of the problems, because we use that. We are not talking in Gaza. We are not discussing in Gaza will be a new war or not. We are asking when it will happen. Yeah. We are waiting for it. Every day by day, we are saying when it will happen, in the summer, in Ramadan, in the winter, to prepare ourselves how to live inside this world. This is what happened in 2014. I wish we can see the videos here. Just to show you, yes, just to show you Gaza before the war and after the war. To see how much a change happened. How this city, how this area had been completely destroyed for no reason. We talk about how much difficult the life is. But it is a city. It is 2 million people that are living there. And they are trying. Yeah, this one. So yeah, this is the way that the people are trying to find space for a life, to try to find part of hope, something just to live. They are running in the streets, they are making marathons, they are going to walk, they are trying to forget about everything, to do part of this life. And this is the way. This is Gaza. They are running. This is marathon for the people, for giving the community hope that we are. If you see some people running in the street, they are happy, they are making sport. Of course, you have some hope, and you will be a little bit out of your problems. And this is Gaza from before. It's 2 months before the 2014 war. This is the life. This is the city. Now you will see Shajaiya. This is area east of Gaza. Live in Shajaiya something like 300,000 Palestinians. You will see it while the people are owning them house, they are trying to fix them life. At least they are trying to survive in very bad condition. This is Shajaiya, and it's a lot of, it's crowded area, it's full of. This is Shajaiya after. Just look to the picture. Try to find where the house is. This is 300,000 Palestinians. They left those houses And now, till now, 1.5 years after, they are in the streets. They are in tents. They are in caravans. They are in school. And everybody's lying when they are talking about rebuilding Gaza. How to rebuild this area? Look to that. It is earthquake. It is not a war. Because the Israelis want to punish all the Palestinians. They want only to destroy. They are not, fighting here. Because everybody, you know, all the people left these houses. They asked 250,000 Palestinians to leave, and they left. They left, and they have a dream that they will return back to them houses, and it will be there. And this is the photo in Beit Hanun. It is a village there. It's completely destroyed. All the houses in Beit Hanun. They left no one. They destroyed all the city completely. Now we need billions of dollars just to take this rubble out. You know, this is, and all the international community talk about rebuilding Gaza. How to rebuild that? We need infrastructure to rebuild that. You know what? They destroy all the factories. The cement factories, they destroyed it in Gaza. And they are not allowing the cement or the iron or any kinds of infrastructure to get inside Gaza. And they are talking about rebuilding Gaza. This is Gaza after the war. If anybody can see that, you can imagine how much difficult to think for him to think about the continuous of the life. This is the other video. I want you to see it. Because Israel all the time they said, wait a minute. Israel all the time they said it was fighting and we are fighting back. So for that, the destroying which happened. But now I'll show you a video. It is from the Israeli side. It is not a Palestinian video. It is Israeli video. Show how they destroyed Gaza, Shaja'iya, in 1 hour. Yeah. In 1 hour, how much the change which happened in 1 hour. Look to the timing here. Play it and look at the timing here. It is in 1 hour. And look to the, you see the houses here. Look what's happening, what will happen in the houses after 1 hour. Look, this is start at 4:05 GMT.
Is that artillery?
It is tanks. It is tanks. Yeah. It is 4:13.
And you're watching
it. It is 4:13.
You're watching it from Israel.
Yes, it is Israeli video. It is not Palestinian video. It is the Israeli army video. So it's 4:30. It is 4:40.
Had people been evacuated?
Yes. Yeah. The people left because they asked the people to leave. They left. But they left everything there. It's 4:53. This is the difference between the two, in 4 o'clock and in 5 o'clock. Look, this is, and you saw in the video, it was no fighting. It was no kind, nothing there. This is the way which Israel used to do in the war in 2004. It's happening in Shaja'iya. We catch it by video here. It's in Rafah, in the Shaja'iya, and everywhere. In one day in Rafah, they killed 350. In not in one day, it is in 20 minutes. 350. In this war, 2,800 Palestinians had been killed. 55,000 houses had been destroyed. All the farms, all the trees, the farms close to the border had been damaged and destroyed. And till now, we are waiting for the rebuilding of Gaza. They talk about money, they talk about help, they talk about how to help the Palestinian, but in the same time, there's two issues. The blockade around Gaza will not allow anything to happen. And the occupation, this is the reason. So we are not sure, and the international community are not sure that if they will rebuild Gaza, the next war, what will happen in the next war, and maybe it will destroy everything once again. So this is the idea, is we don't want to make our life bitter under the occupation. Of course, we deserve and we want to be in good life. But if the international community, if the world want to help us, the United Nations want to help us, if the United States want to help us, just to end the occupation. Sometimes they are talking about, how the Palestinian, there are conflict in the Palestinian community. Yeah, I mean, let us kill each other. Don't worry about us, just go out from our land. And then we can, we can deal with everybody there. This is the idea, is how to end the invitation. Anyone want to make peace, to think about peace, to think about justice, supposed to raise his voice to the end of the occupation. Thank you so much.
So thank you, CJ Pip, for organizing this event. And I'm so thrilled to see a packed room to hear about Gaza when Gaza has all but disappeared from the headlines. And I'm really thrilled and honored that we have Dr. Abu Tharafa today, that you are able to make it here despite the siege. I've been managing editor for the Electronic Intifada for like 10 years now, and I've only met our contributors from Gaza. I've only met two of them ever, and that was Rafat Abu al-Arir and Yusuf al-Jamal, who came here in 2014, before the summer war. And we saw the video of Shaja'iya, and Rafat, his family is from Shaja'iya, and his brother didn't survive the massacre, and their family's home was destroyed. So the situation in Gaza is as dire as ever, and I agree with my co-presenter that the UN's prediction in 2012 that Gaza would be unlivable by the year 2020 is a conservative estimate at best. So many of you are probably aware of the destruction wrought by Israel's 51 consecutive days of bombing in July and August 2014, the scale of which is completely unprecedented in the 50 years of Israeli occupation of Gaza. And I'd like to emphasize that it was a 51-day war and not a 50-day war, as the New York Times and other corporate media repeatedly say. The writer Rod Such noted for the Electronic Intifada in his review of Max Blumenthal's excellent book, The 51-Day War, that, quote, "For the Times, 50 days means the war started on 8 July when Hamas's military wing fired rockets into southern Israel, not on 7 July when Israel, as even some Israeli media acknowledge, broke its previous ceasefire agreement with Hamas by killing seven of its members in an airstrike." So this was a war of Israel's own choosing and not one of defense. And the reality is that all of Gaza was targeted. And because of Israel and Egypt's long-standing closure of Gaza's crossings, of which there is really only one for the nearly 2.2 million people in Gaza, which, as we have heard, are a population of refugees originally displaced from the lands now called Israel, there was no safe refuge for anyone in Gaza for those 51 days. As Israel bombed houses, United Nations-run schools where displaced persons were being sheltered, mosques, ambulances, media towers, cemeteries, and even a geriatric hospital. The widespread loss included a death toll of approximately 2,200 Palestinians, including more than 500 children. More than 70% of those killed by Israel were civilians, and many were killed while sheltering in their own homes. According to UN figures, 142 families in Gaza lost three or more members in a single Israeli strike. More than 11,000 Palestinians were injured, with 10% of these victims suffering severe injuries resulting in permanent disabilities. On the Israeli side, 66 soldiers and 6 civilians were killed as a result of rocket fire and mortar fire from Gaza and by Israeli-friendly fire. And I'd like to mention that the war had a particular impact on women. Some 300 women, of whom at least 16 were pregnant, and some 200 girls were killed in the summer of 2014, and more than 2,000 women and hundreds of girls were injured, and approximately 800 women were widowed. During the second half of 2014, the number of registered cases of maternal and neonatal mortality doubled compared to the first half of the year. And I'd also like to add that even before the summer 2014 attack, the rate of infant mortality in Gaza went up for the first time in 50 years. The number of babies dying before they turn 4 weeks old soaring by 70% between the years 2008 and 2013. And the United Nations identifies the Israeli blockade on Gaza as the most likely factor for this shocking phenomenon. And in addition to the cost in human lives, by the time a ceasefire was declared on 26 August 2014, more than 15,000 housing units in Gaza were badly damaged, including more than 2,000 which were completely destroyed, and 100,000 people were displaced. And while Israel said that the target of this military campaign was Hamas, the reality is that it targeted civilians and civilian infrastructure. The war devastated homes, roads, farms, factories, water and sanitation systems, and communication networks. More than 450 businesses, mosques, schools, health clinics, and other civilian structures were damaged or destroyed. And I think we can't talk about the situation of Gaza's water infrastructure enough. So a preliminary estimate after the 2014 war found that 12% of Gaza's wells were destroyed or damaged, and tens of thousands of meters of water networks were damaged. Most of Gaza's water is unfit for human consumption, like nearly 100%, and a properly functioning sewage system no longer exists in Gaza. The power needed to run Gaza's sewage and water treatment facilities is severely limited, both because of fuel shortages and because Gaza's only power plant was bombed and knocked out of commission by Israel in July 2014. And despite repairs to the electrical grid, most areas of Gaza get less than 12 hours of electricity a day. And I'll just mention that the Gaza-based journalist Mohammed Omar had a very good and detailed article about the situation of water in Gaza recently for the publication Middle East Eye. So today, according to UN figures, some 40% of Gaza's population receive water for only 5 to 8 hours, only once every 3 days. And some 60% resort to private, unregulated water suppliers with lower and largely unmonitored hygiene standards, exposing people to severe public health risks. And Israel, meanwhile, restricts items such as pumps, drilling equipment, and disinfectant chemicals because it says they could potentially be used by armed groups for military purposes. So Mohammed Omar, I thought, summed this up very well, what this means for the average citizen in Gaza, when he tweeted yesterday, "For the second day, no electricity in Rafah, no shower, no water, no toilet flush." The 2014 war was, of course, also catastrophic for Gaza's already long-suffering economy. According to a report from the United Nations Trade and Development Agency, UNCTAD, released late last year, three successive full-scale Israeli military attacks on Gaza since the year 2008, on top of nearly a decade of Israeli and Egyptian blockade, have ravaged the territory's infrastructure, destroyed its productive capacity, hindered any meaningful reconstruction, and left its population poorer than any time in 20 years. Unemployment in Gaza has reached 44%, the highest level on record, and thought to be the highest level in the world. And this is more than double the rate of unemployment in the occupied West Bank. That number skyrockets when we consider youth unemployment, which is at more than 60%. And while the phenomenon of child labor is on the fall worldwide, it's actually on the rise in Gaza. In the last 5 years, the number of working children between the ages of 10 and 17 has doubled to almost 10,000 in the territory, according to the Palestinian Bureau of Statistics. The Bureau said that nearly 3,000 of these children are below the legal employment age of 15. Yet, as the news agency Reuters recently reported, economists in Gaza say that the number of underage workers is probably twice as high. So even before the summer 2014 attack and the further deterioration in the economy, 3 out of 5 households in Gaza and 1 out of 5 in the West Bank were food insecure, meaning that they could not guarantee a reliable and sufficient supply of affordable and nutritious food. And here's one more startling indicator of the de-development of Gaza's economy. In the year 2000, just 72,000 people in Gaza were dependent on UN food rations. In May last year, that figure reached 868,000, almost half the population. With the 2014 Israeli assault on Gaza, according to the United Nations Trade and Development Agency report, Israel, quote, effectively eliminated what was left of the middle class, sending almost all of the population into destitution and dependence on international humanitarian aid, end quote. Meanwhile, businesses in Gaza told the World Bank last year that, quote, they are hesitant to invest in capacity expansion to reach export markets because of the extremely uncertain political outlook and the related likelihood of another war or restrictions being imposed, end quote. Put more simply, few in Gaza are willing to spend scarce money building a business only for it to be destroyed again by Israel or its products warehoused at the border. So one of the results of this dire situation in Gaza is massive brain drain. When Egypt opened the Rafah crossing, the sole point of exit and entry for basically everybody in Gaza for 3 days in February this year, more than 25,000 people registered to cross, but fewer than 2,500 made it. Samir Abu Mudalala, an economic analyst and head of the Department of Economics at Al-Azhar University in Gaza, told Electronic Intifada this year that more than 100,000 university graduates in Gaza are unemployed. And the lack of prospects for the future are spurring young people to get out of Gaza if they're lucky enough to find a way to do so. The numbers are dangerous, the economist told us. He said, the Palestinian economy will suffer from a shortage of people who may be able to develop the national economy and increase GDP. At the same time, we will face a political challenge because of instead of sticking to their land, educated Palestinians look forward to leaving it. Gaza's humanitarian crisis is a manufactured one that requires political action. During the 51 days of bombing in the summer of 2014, the unanimous cry from Gaza was not just for a ceasefire and an end to the bloodshed, a return to the status quo of slow suffocation under siege and complete impunity for Israeli war crimes and constant violation of Palestinian rights was not tenable. Gaza's staggering sacrifice, more than 1 in 1,000 of its residents were killed that summer, demanded the fulfillment of basic rights. The August 2014 ceasefire deal brokered by Egypt, Israel's partner in the closure of Gaza, did bring an end to the bloodshed. And while the exact terms of the August 2014 ceasefire were never made transparent to the public, it reportedly called for the opening of Gaza's crossings, allowing the entry of reconstruction materials needed to rebuild Gaza's devastated neighborhoods, the extension of the permitted fishing areas off of Gaza's shore, which you can see here, and the relaxation of restrictions in the areas along Gaza's perimeter fence with Israel, which include much of its fertile land. So how has the ceasefire held up? The journalist Ben White reported last month that according to Israeli government figures, 36 rockets have been fired from Gaza into Israel since the ceasefire, but none by Hamas. Israel's own defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, recently stated that Hamas has not fired a single rocket nor even a single bullet from Gaza since the declaration of the ceasefire. Yet Palestinian civilians in Gaza continue to be killed. After the firing of 4 rockets from Gaza into Israel by a rogue group last month, causing no injuries or damage, Israel bombed northern Gaza, causing a roof to collapse in a home already damaged by Israeli bombing in 2014. That roof fell on two sleeping children, a brother and a sister, causing fatal injuries to them both. A pregnant woman and her two-year-old daughter were similarly killed during an airstrike in southern Gaza last October. Last year in Gaza, a total of 25 Palestinians were killed by Israeli fire, many of them unarmed protesters demonstrating in the areas along Gaza's boundary with Israel. Israel fires on farmers and scavengers and other civilians in the so-called buffer zone area on a regular basis. This poorly defined area ranges from 300 to 500 meters along the inside perimeter of Gaza. And it's kind of hard to see on this map, but it's the part in red that's basically along the perimeter of Gaza. Since 2008, according to the research group Corporate Watch, more than 50 Palestinians have been killed in the so-called buffer zone. The UN says that this zone also takes up 17% of Gaza's total area, making up to one-third of its farmland unsafe for cultivation. Areas that once held olive and citrus trees have now been bulldozed by Israeli forces. Even though Palestinians are routinely shot at from distances of greater than 300 meters, farmers whose land lies near the boundary with Israel have no choice but to continue to cultivate these areas despite the danger. The UN compiles data. I think what happens in Palestine is probably like the most well-documented human rights violations on earth. Like, it astounds me that there's so much data and yet nothing, no political action. It's quite astonishing and quite demoralizing. So the UN very studiously compiles data every week on attacks on civilians. And in the first 3 months of this year alone, there were 100 incidents of Israeli forces opening fire at Palestinian civilians and property on land and at sea in Gaza in just January through May this year. So regarding the reconstruction of Gaza, the damage incurred by Israel in the summer of 2014 totaled almost $8 billion, according to the Palestinian Economic Council for Development and Reconstruction, which is a body belonging to the Western-backed Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. 2 months after the ceasefire, there was a donor conference in Cairo where $5.4 billion was pledged by Western and Arab governments towards the rebuilding of Gaza. At the time, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank announced that nearly half of that would go to its own coffers for unspecified purposes, leaving $3.5 billion for Gaza. Yet despite the billions pledged, exactly 1 year after that donor conference, only one refugee family's home in Gaza had been completely rebuilt with UN support. And 1 year after that, more than 16,000 families in Gaza and more than 90,000 individuals were still displaced at the end of 2015. During this past winter, approximately 1,150 displaced families were living in temporary caravan shelters donated as humanitarian aid. Yet those shelters do not provide adequate protection from severe winter weather. Last month, a toddler named Hamade Khaled Dardisi, who was living with his family in a caravan in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip, died of hypothermia, and his twin sister was hospitalized as a result of the extreme cold. So why are families like the Dardisis in Khan Yunis still living in temporary inadequate shelter? Partly it's because governments who pledged money for Gaza's reconstruction haven't paid up. As of the end of February 2016, 39% of the $3.5 billion in pledge had been disbursed, so more than 60% is unaccounted for. Reconstruction, of course, has also been hampered by Israel's refusal to allow many building supplies into Gaza on the pretext that some items could prove useful to Hamas or other armed groups. Israel limits the amount of concrete, steel bars, electrical goods, pipes, and wood thicker than 1 centimeter that may enter Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, known as UNRWA, has complained that aid agencies have to deal with a lengthy and cumbersome approval process in order to access essential material for rebuilding. The UN unfortunately brokered this very cumbersome process that has hindered its work serving refugees in Gaza. With Israeli and Palestinian Authority complicity, the UN put into place the so-called Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism. As the Electronic Intifada reported in October 2014, this complicated and secretive system of surveillance and Israeli pre-approval would give Israel even more intrusive control over the lives of Palestinians in Gaza, who will be subjected to onerous ongoing monitoring as they try to rebuild their houses, communities, and lives following Israel's summer massacre. So under the guise of reconstruction, the mechanism stipulates that the UN monitor and gather private information about Palestinian households to be passed on to Israel, which will have a veto over which families get aid to rebuild their homes. So the aid worker who briefed the Electronic Intifada on the secret meeting in which this plan was unveiled told us, quote, "This is the next stage of Israel's blockade of Gaza. It started with a very crude blanket blockade where pencils and coriander were not allowed in. But now it is becoming much more sophisticated, like the occupation of the West Bank. And now the international actors are being embedded and made complicit in the siege." On top of that, as a leading expert on United Nations law warned in a 21-page legal brief commissioned by Diakonia, which is a major Swedish development group that receives funding from the Swedish government, the EU, and the UN, and which was obtained by the Electronic Intifada, the database of personal details of Palestinians in Gaza created under the terms of the Gaza Reconstruction Mechanism violates Palestinians' right to life because, as this expert said, potential misuse of the database by the government of Israel for the identification of targets in the next attack. So despite the calls from Gaza in the summer of 2014, the ceasefire was not enough. Israel now enjoys tighter control over the territory than ever. And Israel actually profits from this control, as has been demonstrated by research by groups such as Who Profits and Corporate Watch. So not only does Israel prohibit imports to Gaza, it severely limits exports. Virtually no produce from Gaza is allowed into the Israeli or West Bank markets, which are traditionally Gaza's biggest customers. So from the time that Israel imposed its blockade in 2007 up until November 2014, a monthly average of 13.5 trucks left Gaza carrying exports, just 1% of the monthly average of goods shipped out of Gaza prior to the closure. By contrast, already this year, more than 22,000 trucks have entered Gaza, many carrying Israeli produce considered unsuitable for international export. Dumping it on the captive market in Gaza further undermines local farmers. The trickle of exports that Israel permits from Gaza go to primarily European markets, but this is only allowed through Israeli export companies that profit from the situation by taking commissions and selling Gaza's products for far higher prices than they pay the producers. Tavri Juma of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees told the research group Corporate Watch that, quote, "The Israelis export Palestinian produce and export it with an Israeli label. For example, they export roses from Gaza for nickels and dimes and sell them for a lot of money," end quote. Mohammed Zawaid of Gaza's only export company, Palestine Crops, told Corporate Watch that part of the problem is that Palestine lacks its own barcode, and so any produce exported through Israel carries an Israeli one. "We have our own stickers," Zawaid said, "but the Israeli export company Arava has asked for them to be smaller, and often Arava stickers are put on top of ours. Our produce is taken inside Israel by the Israeli company and then taken to a packing station where it is repackaged." It's also worth noting that Corporate Watch reports that while many of the farmers they interviewed support boycott, divestment, and sanctions, they also want the opportunity to export their produce and make a living. This presents a quandary because a boycott of Israeli export companies like Arava will include Palestinian products as well. Even so, the farmers interviewed maintain their support for boycott, divestment, and sanctions measures on Israel as a long-term strategy that outweighs the limited benefits of the current very low export levels. One farmer from Ez Zeitun told Corporate Watch, "What we need is people to stand with us against the occupation. By supporting boycott, divestment, and sanctions, you support the farmers, both directly and indirectly, and this is a good thing for people here in Gaza." So both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are a captive market for Israeli products and constitute a primary export destination for Israel, while Israeli restrictions hinder the productivity capacity of the Palestinian economy. Last year, Israeli goods represented 58% of total imports to the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The value of Israeli goods sold to the West Bank and Gaza stood at $3.4 billion in 2013, according to the Israeli government's own statistics. In 2014, it fell to $2.9 billion, a drop of almost one-fifth. And the World Bank euphemistically attributes this to Palestinians opting to buy other products. They avoided the word boycott. You can actually like do a word search for like this 120-page report, and doesn't mention either the occupation, like the word occupation, or boycott once. So meanwhile, as the reconstruction of Gaza is being financed by third-party states, Israel is profiting from the destruction caused by its weaponry and its weaponry technology, which it boasts as battle-tested at international arms fairs. So as I mentioned, the reconstruction is being financed by third-party states, even though under international humanitarian law, it is Israel as the occupying power, which is obliged to deliver and pay for services. But of course, Israel has outsourced this responsibility to the quasi-autonomous Palestinian Authority and foreign organizations and governments ever since the signing of the Oslo Accords in the mid-90s. So one company that stands to profit quite handsomely from the reconstruction of Gaza is Nesher, Israel's sole cement producer. The research group Who Profits has demonstrated how the Israeli construction market and companies like Nesher profit from the destruction Israel has wrought on Gaza thanks to the reconstruction agreement between Israel, the Palestinian Authority, and the UN. Who Profits states, quote, "The company holds a monopoly over the Israeli and Palestinian cement markets. Since the company sells more than 85% of all cement in Israel, it is safe to assume that the separation wall, most if not all checkpoints, West Bank settlements, and Israeli infrastructure in the West Bank are built with Nesher cement. The West Bank and the Gaza Strip constitute a captive market for Nesher cement and a source of large-scale revenues. Moreover, the company has actively tried to block Jordanian competitors from operating in the Palestinian market. Nesher has been reaping enormous profit under the framework of the UN-sponsored Gaza reconstruction mechanism. As it is the sole Israeli cement provider and holds a monopoly over the Israeli market, it has secured economic gains and corporate growth through its exploitation of the ruins of Palestinian homes from the last Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip. In recent months, Nesher cement was seen throughout the Gaza Strip in massive quantities." And you can actually see the photos of this on the Who Profits website. So meanwhile, while the authorities in Gaza have tried to regulate the prices because the scale of demand and the limited supply means that prices for construction materials have inflated by as much as 40%. As soon as the authorities in Gaza tried to impose any regulations on this, Israel cut off the supply of cement with the unsupported claim that the cement was being diverted from reconstruction projects by Hamas for its own purposes, even though the Gaza reconstruction mechanism stipulates that supplies are monitored by surveillance cameras that are installed in every vendor's storage house, transmitting video 24 hours a day. So not only has Israel not been held accountable for the death and destruction it wrought on Gaza, which has disappeared from the headlines, it has been rewarded with more control over Palestinians' lives than ever by the UN and the PA under the guise of this reconstruction mechanism, and the Obama administration, which expedited the transfer of tank rounds and illumination rounds for grenade launchers to Israel while it was slaughtering families by the dozens in Gaza in 2014, has this year offered Israel the largest single pledge of military assistance to any country in U.S. history. And this is where we come in. Elected officials must continue to hear from constituents that they want an end to the siege on Gaza and an end to business as usual with Israel. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns are meanwhile essential for both raising awareness of Israel's violations of Palestinian rights and for piercing its impunity. Efforts like the upcoming Gaza 5K let Palestinians in Gaza know that they haven't been completely forgotten. There are many people in this room here today who have been leading these efforts for justice for Palestinians, and hopefully we'll get a chance to hear about some of those in better detail. But I'd like to conclude by noting that one of the best things about my work with the Electronic Intifada is that I get to work with and help develop the skills of young writers in Gaza. Gaza, by the way, has an extremely young population. More than half of the population is under the age of 18. And one of the effects of the siege is that young people in Gaza are denied opportunity for the exchange of knowledge, which has had a particularly harmful impact on its medical sector. There is a lack of many specialized medical treatments in Gaza, compelling people to seek treatment elsewhere. There are more than 3,500 medical patients currently waiting for permission to cross Rafah crossing into Egypt to seek medical treatment. So I want to conclude by pointing to these young writers who are most keen to tell Gaza's positive stories so that the world knows that it's not just a place of suffering, of rubble, and destitution. Recent stories by these young writers in Gaza published on the Electronic Intifada include a profile of a team of volunteers who dress up as clown doctors and visit pediatric wards at hospitals to cheer up Gaza's youngest patients. These stories include features on volunteer initiatives to train women to become entrepreneurs. They include stories on aspiring musicians who, lacking opportunities for training in Gaza, turn to the internet to learn a new skill and find personal fulfillment in the absence of any ability to plan for the future. The stories include a project to paint in bright colors the temporary caravans housing displaced families so that people have a sense that they have some control over the untenable situation in which they've been flung into. There is a tremendous wealth of creativity, ingenuity, and talent in Gaza, and we must continue to do all that we can so that all of Gaza and all of Palestine's young people can have the future denied to them by occupation, siege, and constant war. Thank you.